A reading from the letter to the Hebrews. It was fitting that God, for whom and through whom all things exist, in bringing many children to glory, should make the pioneer of their salvation perfect through sufferings. For the one who sanctifies and those who are sanctified all have one Father. For this reason, Jesus is not ashamed to call them brothers and sisters, saying, I will proclaim your name to my brothers and sisters. In the midst of the congregation, I will praise you. And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, here am I and the children whom God has given me. Since, therefore, the children share flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared the same things, so that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is, the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by the fear of death. For it is clear that he did not come to help angels, but the descendants of Abraham. Therefore, he had to become like his brothers and sisters in every respect, so that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God, to make a sacrifice of atonement for the sins of the people. Because he himself was tested by what he suffered, he is able to help those who are being tested. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. The Lord be with you. The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Matthew. Now after the Magi had left, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother by night, and went to Egypt, and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I have called my son." When Herod saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, he was infuriated, and he sent and killed all the children in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had learned from the wise men. Then was fulfilled what had been spoken through the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing and loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be consoled because they are no more. When Herod died, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who were seeking the child's life are dead." Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was ruling over Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. And after being warned in a dream, he went away to the district of Galilee. There he made his home in a town called Nazareth, so that what had been spoken through the prophets might be fulfilled. He will be called a Nazarene. The Gospel of Christ. I am pretty confident in thinking that in your homes, you do not have any Christmas cards, any decorations, any dioramas, any music playing that has anything to do with the gospel that we just read today. It's part of the Christmas story. But the idea that King Herod wanted to kill Jesus is a part we usually leave out, and we definitely leave out the part that he actually goes and kills all the little children under 2 years of age in Bethlehem. It's part of the story, but we choose not to include it. And of course, the reason for that is it's not a fun part of the story at all. There's nothing delightful about it. It ruins the whole sense and spirit of Christmas. I said on Christmas Eve at our candlelight service, Christmas is the best time of the year, and that story would make it less so. But nevertheless, it's in there. It's in the Gospel of Matthew, and if we're going to read the entire story, we have to include that. And the moment we have to include it, we have to think about what on earth does it mean? What do we do with this? How do we even begin to process this story? The lectionary is what assigned these readings for us today, pairing up Hebrews with this Gospel passage. And so that is supposed to give us, I guess, a little bit of a hint of what we might do. And when we look at the letter to the Hebrews, we read there about how it was God's intention to make sure that Jesus, who had come not to save angels but to save human beings, would be like us in every way. And so he said it's fitting that God would make the pioneer of their salvation, that is Jesus, it is fitting that God would make Jesus perfect through suffering, that Jesus would experience the same kinds of sufferings that we do. Now, there's no question that in the passage here in the letter to the Hebrews, he is talking about Jesus's death, his crucifixion, all of that. Absolutely, that's what he's talking about. You can't miss that at all. He talks about the sacrifice being made. But nevertheless, I think the reason why the lectionary paired this reading up with the gospel reading is to say, hey, look, when Jesus was born, it wasn't a cakewalk for him, right? Like, he was born in really austere circumstances. There wasn't enough room for them to have a proper room in Bethlehem, so he's born surrounded by animals. His first bed is a feeding trough. Jesus was not born to a wealthy family. When they have his purification ceremony, when he's about a month old, they bring two young pigeons as a sacrifice. And the Torah says that you're supposed to bring a lamb or something like that. I forget which animal you're supposed to bring. But if you can't afford that, you can get away with just offering a couple of birds. So the fact that Mary and Joseph offered a couple of birds is showing that they weren't rolling in dough. You know, Jesus did not show up in a really wealthy family. So there's suffering right out of the gate in that sense. And then I'm thinking that the intention is probably that the story of Herod's persecution of Jesus and their flight to Egypt, as it's called, is meant to illustrate further Jesus' suffering at a very, very young age. His life was threatened. He narrowly escaped death in Bethlehem. He had to go with his family to a foreign country for a while, and we don't know how much time was suggested in the Gospel of Matthew that they were gone. But the idea is he's now living not in his own home and all of this. So, you know, Jesus was suffering right out of the gate. And then when they came back to Israel, because Herod's brother was now reigning, there was a concern about his safety there. So they had to relocate again to the north and live up in Nazareth in Galilee instead. And so I think the idea was to show that suffering referenced in Hebrews being meant to include the difficulty of Jesus' life that we see in the Gospel of Matthew. But there's a problem with trying to make that connection. Because so long as Jesus is in the arms of his mother, at even under age 2, as long as he's getting enough to eat and enough to drink, he's not suffering at all. No matter what you do. I mean, the parents are suffering. Mary and Joseph are the ones that have to make the journey and go live in Egypt and fret and concern themselves. But a child who's 2 years old and younger, if they're in their loving parents' arms, they're secure, they're feeling good, they don't know what's going on, they don't know that this isn't normal. They're just living life. So to try to say that Jesus was suffering right out of the gate in the Gospel of Matthew is really not really true in that sense. So the connection is strained. And then the part that's even more glaring is the fact that this story includes what we have come to call the slaughter of the innocents, or the martyrdom of the innocents. The idea that these children in Bethlehem all died, were all put to death by the sword. That is the part that we leave out the most, because it's the most disturbing. And the church has certainly had to try to figure out how to deal with it. And there are basically three ways, I would suggest, that we have been able to come to deal with this passage. Because the challenge is simply this, and here's the thing that makes this so glaring. When we first read the passage and we just go, yeah, wow, whew, Jesus nearly made a, you know, got a narrow escape there, that was really close, and yeah, it's too bad that Herod did that. Herod was a crazy guy, and it's true. King Herod, historically, was absolutely paranoid, jealous for his reign. He had no problem with putting people to death, even members of his own family. If he felt that they were a perceived threat, he would actually actually get rid of people and just have them killed and stuff. He would do that. So it's totally plausible that he, after being double-crossed by the Magi, because, of course, he had told the Magi, hey, go find out where the baby is living in Bethlehem, then come back and tell me so that I can worship him too. You know, of course, he just wants to know where Jesus is so he can kill Jesus. But the wise men don't go back. They just head home rather than come back to Jerusalem. And once Herod realizes that they've gone, well, then he thinks, okay, the only way I'm going to get rid of this guy who's supposed to be the king of Israel, this little baby, is to go and kill all the kids in Bethlehem to make sure I get him. And so that's what they said he did. And it's certainly a plausible thing. Now, we don't have any archaeological record of any such thing happening. That in itself isn't sufficient evidence to say that it didn't happen, but I'm just saying, it's in Matthew, but this is the only place we see this reference. But the more disturbing part is thinking that, okay, here Herod really wants to kill Jesus so bad, because he doesn't know where Jesus lives, apart from the fact that he's in Bethlehem, he's going to kill all the kids in Bethlehem. And he does. Except that an angel appears to Joseph in a dream and wakes him up and says, hey, look out, Herod is going to come and kill Jesus, so get out of here, go fly to Egypt, get out of here, go away. And so Joseph does. And then when Herod comes in to kill all the kids in Bethlehem, he succeeds in doing that, but of course has missed out on Jesus. So the question is, why did God allow that to happen? If God could send an angel to Joseph to wake him up and say, hey, your kid's life is at risk, couldn't he have sent another bunch of angels to the other families too? And had it that there weren't any kids under age 2 in Bethlehem, and that way there'd be nobody for Herod to kill? I think that's possible. But God obviously didn't do it that way. God, it seems, was content with allowing all these other children to be put to death, which is really concerning. Now, when we talk about the massacre of the innocents or the slaughter of the innocent ones, sometimes we picture, you know, dozens and dozens of kids being put to death. Well, Bethlehem wasn't that big, so it wouldn't have been a huge number of kids at that time. But even if it was like a half a dozen, like if we heard that there was a school shooting and 6 kindergartners had gotten killed or something, like we'd be horrified at that, right? It's terrible. It absolutely is. So it doesn't matter that it would have been a relatively small number of kids versus a large number. It's still the thought of what had happened, that a soldier would barge into your door and take your kid out of your arms and kill them in front of your eyes is absolutely disturbing. And one has to ask the question, why didn't God just get all the kids out? Why just Jesus? So how are we to deal with this? Well, one way to deal with it is to just simply take it as, well, God is sovereign. God's ways are higher than our ways. Everything happens for a reason. You know, we don't know the end from the beginning like God does. God has some plan and purpose or whatever. And so we just have to accept that that's what God did, and we can't talk back to God because God's God and we're not. And so we just have to suck it up and say, I don't know, but God in his eternal grace and mercy and loving kindness somehow saw fit that this was just fine. And we just have to trust. That's probably the simplest way to go with it. And of course, the main point of this sermon, the main point of that part of the story is to say, phew, Jesus got away. It's a good thing he did, because if he didn't get away, then he wouldn't have grown up to be our Savior, right? That's how we're meant to think in reading the story. The second way is to look more closely at the death of all of these children and try to find some kind of significance or meaning in their death. And one way that the church decided to do this early on in its history was, and I had alluded to this a little bit earlier, to see all of the children that were put to death in Bethlehem as being the first martyrs for the sake of Christ. That they would be what can be known as proto-martyrs, right? The children did not know Jesus. They didn't believe in Jesus. They had no awareness of Jesus being there, except maybe if they had a mom and tots group and they were playing together or something. You know what I mean? But there's no sense of them, you know, going to their deaths because of a particular cause or something. And so that's why they might would be referred to as proto-martyrs. And as a result, there is a day on the Christian calendar that commemorates this massacre of the innocents. It is December 28th. which happens to be today. Now, it is it's a commemoration on the calendar that you usually don't do on Sunday. It's not a significant enough event to take precedence on a Sunday, so it would normally be moved to tomorrow. But I'm bringing it up today because that's what our readings are. So today is the day that we commemorate this. And so there's a special day on the calendar for us to consider them. We can think of these young children as, you know, early martyrs. It was because of Christ that they went to their deaths. And there is even an attempt to try to recognize that because there's all sorts of unjust death that happens around the world, things that shouldn't happen, innocent people put to death, is kind of like this day is meant to bring our attention to people in that situation as well. And that certainly is a better way of handling it than the first way, right? To try to see how we could let this event spur us on to something more significant and something more helpful. But then, of course, the idea of calling all of the children martyrs, part of the reason for that is the early church felt that anybody who gave their lives for the sake of Christ Jesus, they had a special standing with God in heaven and this kind of thing. And so calling them martyrs was meant to also be a bit of a salve, a bit of an encouragement to the parents, you know, that their kid did not die in vain and that kind of thing. But I can't help but think that that just feels like a bit of a reach. Right? Like, here's the deal. If Jesus had not been, like if Joseph had not been warned in a dream, then Herod would have come in and killed all the kids, including Jesus. Right? They would have all died anyway. The fact that Jesus escaped, Herod still came in and killed all the kids that were in Bethlehem. Like they didn't die so that Jesus could escape. You know what I'm saying? Like, they were going to die regardless because Herod had it in his mind to do so. There was nothing about their death that enabled Jesus to get out. That was simply because an angel had come to tell Joseph to get out of Dodge. So there's still this glaring problem with this part of the story. Like, why on earth would God allow such a thing to happen when there was no need for it? Well, here's how we come to the third possible way to go with it. And this is the view that I have. When I'm all done, you might not agree with everything I say here, and that's fine. There's debate and question about that. But here's what I think about how it is that we can deal with this. And the first thing is to recognize that the only place that this story appears anywhere, first of all, is the Bible itself, and specifically only in the Gospel of Matthew. It isn't referred to anywhere else in the Bible. It is only here. And so we have to think about what is Matthew doing with his gospel, his story of Jesus. Mark wrote his first, didn't have a Christmas story at all. Then Matthew wrote his next, and he took the Gospel of Mark, and he added stuff to it, so that he could make his point about what he's trying to say about Jesus. And so one of the things he added was the whole Christmas story to start with, Matthew's version of the Christmas story. So this is something that Matthew has put there deliberately. Now, what is it that he's trying to do? Well, we understand that Matthew's audience would have been Jewish people, people who are Israelites. They know all about the history of the Hebrew Bible. They follow the Torah, all that stuff. That is who Matthew is writing to. And so, part of the reason we know this, in his gospel, he's quoting the Old Testament all over the place, saying this happened to fulfill what the prophet said over here, and this was to fulfill what was said over here, and he's quoting the Hebrew Bible over and over and over again, because his audience would have been very familiar with it. So he's trying to show how Jesus is filling in the blanks from stuff in the Hebrew Bible. We also see that what Matthew is trying to do is present Jesus as a prophet like Moses. Because I think it was in the book of Numbers that Moses says to the Israelites that one day God will raise up a prophet like me and you must listen to him, right? And so Matthew is trying to show that Jesus is this prophet like Moses. And so one of the things that Moses did, well, it's traditionally said that he did, is the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, the Pentateuch, are often referred to as the books of Moses. And the old tradition is that Moses wrote them all. Well, he might have written parts of them, but he didn't write them all. But nevertheless, those are the five books of Moses. The Gospel of Matthew can be easily broken up into five distinct parts, right? So Jesus has five books. Moses has five books. Moses very notably went on top of a mountain, Mount Sinai, to deliver the two tablets of the Ten Commandments and to give the 613 commands of the Torah to the Israelites. Jesus in Matthew 5, 6, and 7 is giving his Sermon on the Mount. He stands on a mountain and gives his instructions to the Israelites, including six specific references to the Torah, where he quotes the Torah and then says, let me take that in another direction. And so showing an authority like Moses had. We also find that Moses' life was threatened when his story begins. In the book of Exodus, we find that there's an evil king, the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, who is concerned about how many Israelites there are, so he wants to cull the herd. He wants to reduce the number of Israelites living, so he puts out an edict that every Israelite child that is born, every Israelite boy that is born, is to be thrown into the Nile River, that he's to be put to death. So this is what this evil king wants to do. But when Moses is born, his parents put him in a little ark, a little waterproof basket, and they float him down the river. And as a result, his life is spared. He escapes the death of the evil king. Jesus was taken away from the situation so that evil King Herod couldn't kill him. And then, of course, Moses grows up and begins to lead the Israelites out of Egypt to the Promised Land. And in the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus and his family come from Egypt back into the Promised Land, back into Israel. And the fact that Matthew says that this return from Egypt was to fulfill what the prophet said, out of Egypt I have called my son, makes this very, very clear. That's what he's thinking. Now, the interesting thing about that is the prophet that says this is the prophet Hosea. And in Hosea 11:1, which is what he's referring to, here's what this verse says. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. Who is his son? It's Israel. What is the prophet saying? Well, looking back to Egypt, I called Israel out of, sorry, looking back to Exodus, I called Israel, my son, out of Egypt and brought him to the Promised Land. This is past tense. The Hosea is not making a prediction about something. He's saying this is what God had done. But Matthew takes half of that verse and says, see, Jesus too was called out from Egypt. This fulfills what the prophet was saying. And it's a bit of a reach to conclude that this is exactly what the prophet is talking about. Later on here, he says, when it talks about the kids being killed, right? It says, then was fulfilled what had been spoken through the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing and loud lamentation. Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be consoled because they are no more. When you go look that up, that's in Jeremiah 31. And in the middle of this whole chapter of Jeremiah 31 is he's speaking to the idea that there would be restoration for the people of Israel after having been so utterly defeated, having had so many children, loved ones, killed as Babylon besieged them. Thus says the Lord, a voice is heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel was one of the wives of Jacob. Jacob's name was changed to Israel. So, you know, Rachel is kind of like one of the moms of Israel itself as a nation. Rachel is weeping for her children. She refuses to be comforted because they are no more. It goes on, thus says the Lord, keep your voice from weeping and your eyes from your tears, for there is a reward for your work. They shall come back from the land of the enemy. The whole idea behind this reference in Jeremiah is not predicting that there is coming a day when all the moms in Bethlehem are going to weep, but it's saying there is coming the day that the losses incurred in this defeat are going to be overturned by the restoration of Israel back to where they go. When we look at all of these things, it becomes a little bit more difficult to see what Matthew is doing as being absolutely historical. You know, there's one other part of his story, too. It's only in Matthew where there's a star that appears. And when the star appears, first of all, it is said that the Magi who were living in the east saw this star, whatever the phenomenon was. Maybe a nebula blew up or whatever. We don't know. But they interpreted that as being a sign that the king of Israel was born. So they went directly to Jerusalem because that's the capital city of Israel. They went to the temple, or sorry, to the palace because that's where the king lives. Normally, when the next king is born, it's a time of celebration. So they come in and say to Herod, hey, we saw the sign of the new king of Israel being born. Where is he? And Herod's going, what king? You know? And so when Herod hears that there's a threat to his throne, he tells them, okay, go find the child. We understand it's in Bethlehem. That's what the scriptures say. And then let me know. And then it says, the star then began to move and led them to Bethlehem, and the star ended up being directly over the house where Mary and Jesus were. That only happens in Matthew. And that is absolutely impossible. Now, someone can say, well, wait a minute, God can do anything. I get that, but let's understand. If you went outside at night right now and looked up in the sky and looked at all the stars, how could you tell which one of those stars was directly over a house? You can't. Maybe if the star got closer, maybe it could. But if the star got closer, well, then it would be like as big as our sun, for example. And even our sun, when it's overhead, you can't tell exactly which house it's over. But understand, too, that it's no longer nighttime. Right? With the star being that close, it's now daytime. It's not night anymore. And if a star got any closer, not only would the earth burn up from its heat, but it would also be sucked into its gravitational vortex. Like, it just isn't possible for a literal star to move like that and to locate itself over a house. So other ideas that people have thought is, well, maybe there's some kind of comet. Well, same problem. I mean, the comet moves, but it doesn't stop directly over the house. Well, maybe there's some kind of little blob of plasma or something that's floating around. Or maybe it was really an angel. Well, Matthew has no problem with saying that angels show up. Why would he make this one a star? And even then, if he makes it a star when it was really an angel, well, then he's not saying what really happened anyway, right? I mean, there's all these concerns that really come to this. This is my conviction. Because Matthew's intention is to take the story of Jesus, especially the one that was already written by Mark, and add to it a way of showing his Jewish audience, you really need to pay attention to this guy named Jesus, he's like a second Moses to us, Matthew has created this backstory to make this parallel with Moses to help gain an audience from his readers. In other words, I'm suggesting, and I think, that the Gospel of Matthew has a mythical story of Jesus' birth, not an actual historical account of Jesus' birth. He uses plausible things, Magi coming from the east because they saw a sign. Yeah, that kind of thing happened. Herod was a murderous tyrant. Yeah, that kind of thing happened. Like there's this plausibility that's there. But the rest of it is a narrative device to cause the readers to pay closer attention. By seeing it this way, well, now we realize God didn't just let a bunch of babies in Bethlehem get murdered for no good reason. There isn't this case of this injustice being done that we have to try to solve because it didn't happen that way. Matthew is making the point, trying to draw the parallels like it was in Egypt. It's happening again. Jesus is really important. And of course, the only reason anybody is writing Jesus' backstory is because of what it is that he did as a man. And the Gospel of Matthew is being written several decades after Jesus' life. So there's been a lot of thinking about what Jesus had done and processing and understanding and what did his crucifixion mean and all of that. And so it makes sense that people would want to know what happened when this kid was born. And Matthew tells this story, which is a different story from what Luke tells, but that's a different story. So with that, let me reiterate, you may disagree with my third conclusion, and that's okay. I can appreciate it's a challenging thought to think that maybe Matthew's Christmas story didn't really happen. I get that, 100% I get that. But at the same time, we still have this story of the massacre of the innocents that we have to deal with. And we have to understand what to do with that, because it is part of the story. If this story causes you to think more deeply about those who are killed unjustly, children who are put to death for no good reason, people who die, if this story helps you connect with them and moves you to a prayer, a time of prayer and thoughtfulness for those in those circumstances, fantastic. Let it be. I don't want to take anything away from that. But I know that I just can't escape the question about what the character of God is, if he is allowing Jesus to escape, but not the others. In any event, Jesus is the one that we focus our attention on, and the life that he lived and what he said and did for us paints a picture for how we ought to live and how we ought to continue to move forward in our faith. And that, of course, is our goal as we worship here, as we go through the seasons of the year. It just so happens that today's readings aren't very happy for the season.